This is Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm here with the show's producer, Carrie Jr. II.
How you doing, Stephen?
Good. Today is a really good example of a show where we're going to say, you think you know about this thing, but we're going to show you how you really don't know about it. We're going to show you a bunch of things that you don't know.
You didn't know.
We're talking here about poverty and the idea of where poverty comes from, what perpetuates poverty in lots of communities around the country. There's this book that Luke Schaefer of Poverty Solutions at the University of Michigan has written called The Injustice of Place, which looks at a bunch of these rural communities and examines how they got so poor and how they stay so poor.
Yeah, it's those rural communities right there for me, because it's not that I don't think about rural communities when I think of poverty, but I don't usually think when it comes to solutions, and when we talk about it often, it's just not often in that conversation. So it's interesting to hear this book kind of elevate those areas more and tell us more about the history and industry of how it got that way.
Yeah, I'm really curious to hear him talk about how poverty looks different in some of these places than it does in a city like Detroit, where I think we all feel very familiar with the issue of poverty, but also how it's the same. Like, what are the things that we share with Appalachia or the Cotton Belt or the Tobacco Belt that we wouldn't think of? And that's, for me, the strength of a show like this.
I don't think of, or I don't think many people think of, rural communities and city communities having the same type of issues. Like, I understand that they both have issues, but I figured they were unique to their regions.
I used to think that too. And I think if you grow up in a city and don't know anything about a rural community, you think, well, that's different. I started to think differently about that when I graduated from college and my first job was in Lexington, Kentucky, which is right on the edge of Appalachia, of eastern Kentucky, which is one of the poorest regions in the country and has been for, you know, forever, really. But the isolation was the thing that stood out to me as much as anything else. So one of the things that keeps people poor in Detroit is the lack of proximity to anything better, right? And that's getting worse and worse in Detroit. As the city shrinks in population, it's harder and harder if you live in a very poor neighborhood to even get to a better neighborhood with better schools, with better grocery shopping, with better opportunities. You have that same phenomenon in places like Appalachia because of the geography. Right, because it can take you 4 or 5 hours to drive 100 miles in eastern Kentucky, because you're going up the side of one mountain and down the other side of it, and then across the valley, and then up another mountain and down the other side. And so, you know, isolation is a real driver of poverty. When you can't get to something better, you have no way to make your life better. Urban cities have that problem increasingly, and in places like Detroit that are dealing with depopulation, it's getting much, much worse. They've had that problem in eastern Kentucky for decades. So I'm really excited that Luke is here.
Again.
Excited that he wrote the book.
Luke has returned.
Yeah, Luke has returned. He was one of our first guests talking about RX Kids, which he's doing with Mona Hannah Atisha in Flint. But he is always looking into these questions of poverty and how to fix them. So let's get to the interview. Luke Schaefer, welcome back to Created Equal.
It's always great to be with you, Steve.
Yeah. So I want to start here. I think most of us feel like we know a lot about poverty. When we are talking about poverty, we understand poverty, we see poverty. But I think one of the premises of this book, The Injustice of Place, is we don't really know as much about it as we should. We don't know as much about its origins, its legacy, its interconnectedness across communities. And for that reason, we don't really understand as much about how to solve it. Is that a good way to think of the work that goes into this book?
I think that's a great description of the book. I often say this book was a very humbling experience for me.
For you.
For me.
Your job is, is running Poverty Solutions.
I'm supposed to be a poverty expert.
Right, right.
I've been called a poverty expert. I've spent my whole career studying poverty. And so much of this book talks about things and discusses things that I never would have imagined going into the project. Even the very places that we ended up, really, they weren't on my radar. And I think it sort of speaks to me to the importance of the method of research of trying to, you know, let data drive, but then really go in with an open mind that we don't know a lot, that that there's many complicated interlinked systems, and so we need to just go in with a really open mind.
Yeah. So let's talk about the communities that you're looking at here. They are disparate in the sense of all over the place in our country, and some of them are places I know a little bit about. Some of them are places I've never been. But talk about where they are and why they're the ones you focused on.
So a number of years ago, Kathy Eden and I wrote a book called $2 a Day, which was about very, very, very poor families who didn't have a lot of cash. So they might have food assistance and some other things. But what does it mean not to have any money in 21st century America? And so after that, we had this very unusual experience that a program officer at a foundation called us up and said, hey, could we convince you to do a new project about very, very poor places. And we had sort of been thinking along those lines already. So we wanted to be driven by data. So we got all the data on poverty rates all over the country. But we've also been thinking a lot more holistically about how do you really identify poverty? Income's an important piece of the puzzle, but it's pretty crude. You know, you could imagine lots of people well above the poverty line that would still be really having trouble making ends meet. You can imagine some situations where people's incomes are below the poverty line and maybe they're actually doing okay. So we brought in data about health too. We know like how long you live is really shaped by where you live and how much resources you have. And we brought in some data on social mobility too. So that's like if you grow up poor, are you likely to be poor as an adult or rise to the middle class? So we brought all of that into this statistical procedure called principal component analysis. And it ranked every county and every city, the 500 largest cities on this continuum of disadvantage. And we were pretty shocked as folks that have spent most of our lives studying urban places in the north, to find that so many of the very most disadvantaged places in the United States were rural communities, often rural communities in the South. So we started to figure out how to get to know some of these places. So we went to Clay County, Kentucky. That's in eastern Kentucky and central Appalachia.
This is a place that I spent a couple of years as a young reporter. My first job was at the Lexington Herald Leader.
Oh, my gosh.
And
I've been a long-time now subscriber to the Lexington
it's
Herald.
It's a wonderful newspaper in central Kentucky, but it's right on the edge of the coal counties,
that's
as we call them, where Appalachian poverty is, you know, kind of a driving and defining force.
Yeah, and at some point we might talk about the importance of local reporting because some of the stories and understanding these places and important things that have happened have all been driven by local and regional newspapers.
Journalism,
And so we think that's they play a critical role.
Yeah.
We're down in Marion County in South Carolina. So it used to be dominated by cotton, but it's actually the region where the process of bright leaf tobacco, like the curing that allowed cigarettes to spread all over the world, happened right there. So sometimes referred to as the tobacco belt. LaFleur County in Mississippi, which is in the cotton belt, where sort of cotton was, you know, reigned supreme well into the 20th century. And then down in South Texas, Zavala County and Crystal City in South Texas, that became known as the Winter Garden mm-hmm. after they figured out irrigation. It became sort of the bed for tabletop vegetables all over the country.
Yeah. So these are, again, disparate places in just physical terms, but they're also disparate in terms of their makeup and their histories. Appalachia is, of course, a mostly white part of the country, but experiences this kind of poverty. South Carolina and Mississippi have much larger African-American mm-hmm. populations. And then mm-hmm. in Texas, you're talking a lot about a migrant population in some ways. And yet they're all tied together by this extreme poverty. Talk about sort of, I guess, how that disparate nature of these communities ends up kind of in the same place, right? They're different places. Yeah. Why are they all sharing this deep poverty?
Yeah, I think for each place, stories
have been told of them. Yeah.
but in this project, you know, we use the data to find these places. We embedded our teams of researchers, many of which actually hailed from the regions that they were studying. Went there, we had folks living there, and we as the co-authors were visiting repeatedly throughout. And, you know, as we started having our sort of weekly meetings, you know, we started to hear a repeated set of themes, basically. Mm-hmm. So, you know, thinking about coal as this predominant industry in central Appalachia, mm-hmm. The companies that controlled the industry also controlled, like, every facet of a community. And when they pulled out, everything
took everything
out.
With them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Down in LaFleur County, one of our researchers who was there mentioned, did you know that, you know, LaFleur County and Greenwood, Mississippi proudly are the cotton capital of the world? You know, there's like a sign as mm-hmm. you come in. Mm-hmm. Everything was around cotton, you know, and this really hits its heyday in the early 20th century under tenant farming and Jim Crow. So you've got one industry that sort of dominates everything, and the people who control it are a small group who control every aspect of society there. Tobacco, I already mentioned, in the tobacco belt in South Carolina. And then down in South Texas, it becomes this agriculture, right? And so in Crystal City, actually, there are at least two statues that I've seen— 6 or 7 foot statues of Popeye, because it is the spinach capital of the world. So we all have selfies with the Popeye.
The Popeye statues.
Yeah. So there's a lot of pride in this sort of dominance of an industry, but it also creates this pattern of each of these being places that were really dominated by single industry, controlled by a small number of people that required a large and cheap labor force.
Mm-hmm.
And every sort of aspect of society for generations was wrapped around reinforcing that social order, from the economic to the political to the social. And so trying to, like, link those stories together is part of the project of the book.
Yeah. I just want to take a pause there, though, and note you could be describing Southeast Michigan in the same terms, right? The mass manufacturing that develops here in the early part of the 20th century, you know, the revolutionary nature of the auto industry on American life, you know, should have created opportunity for everybody. It did for many, but we have the same kind of underclass that's left behind here, and I'm going to want to talk more about that later and connect to this. But back to these other communities, they have been poor this way for a long time, and it seems as though there isn't an easy answer to, well, how do we create lasting opportunity? I want to be careful about that, too. It's not that there isn't opportunity or that there haven't been opportunities. Yeah. It's the idea of lasting opportunity. So talk about some of those institutional barriers, I guess, that exist in those communities.
We worked on this project starting before the pandemic. And then when we hit the pandemic, we couldn't do the type of work that we were doing of getting to know communities and interviewing.
And you guys were not just going and dropping in and talking to people and then leaving. Right. This was deep, as you would say, as a researcher, deep ethnography, right?
That's right. We were interviewing low-income community residents and community leaders, thinking you get pieces of the puzzle from both. Mm-hmm. We were going to community events. We were subscribing to local newspapers and reading them religiously. And then when the pandemic hit and we were sort of locked inside of our houses, that's when we really turned to history.
Yeah.
And that was another big wake-up call for me. I think social scientists, we have our history books. We understand how history is important. We give a nod to it. And then we proceed with most of our, you know, problem analysis and our solutions in a totally ahistorical manner. Mm-hmm. And as we got to know these communities and this sort of process of internal colonies that we were talking about, of this one industry that dominates everything, it really became clear you have to understand history to really understand what the problems are and why they persist. And we just learned, like, time and time again how important history is. So in some of our statistical models, there are some great researchers, Trayvon Logan from Ohio State, for example, who have developed metrics of segregation from the early 1900s. Mm-hmm. And we have great estimates of things like the number of lynchings. We have estimates of the amount of the concentration of enslavement in 1860. And just taking those factors, we can predict the poverty rate of a place today with incredible precision.
Wow.
Just like—
Based on things that happened a long time ago.
100 or more years ago.
Yeah.
And so that really, you know, often in my work, we talk about sort of the responsibility of an individual— and, you know, people making the right choices. In this case, if I can know what somebody's, you know, future is going to be using factors from 100 to 150 years ago, mm-hmm. it really calls into question how much we can think of any of this as the problems of an individual.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Luke Schaefer about the book, The Injustice of Place. Stay where you are. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. Listening to Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm glad you're with us. Our guest today is Luke Schaefer. He is a professor of social justice and social policy at the University of Michigan. He's the director of Poverty Solutions, which is an initiative to find new ways to prevent and alleviate poverty. He's also the author of a book that came out in 2023 titled The Injustice of Place. He's one of the authors, I should say, of that book. So Luke, when we think about these rural communities in different places, all that find themselves trapped in this cyclical poverty, and you go and you discover that history has a lot to do with why they're in the situation that they're in. Industry has a lot to do with the situation that they're in. It seems to me that in some ways this is an observation of the shortcomings of capitalism as it's been practiced in this country. So why are these places different from other places that mm-hmm. capitalism has had mm-hmm. maybe the same effect, but not to the same mm-hmm. degree. And why can't they get past what happened to them before? And I don't mean that in an accusatory way about the people yeah. who live there, but yeah. why can't we solve for these deep problems?
I do
this
think—
is a very small question. I'm sure it'll take you 2 minutes to answer, right?
All right, 2 minutes. I do think that this is a story, obviously, about capitalism in its most extractive form. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about industries that do violence to the very, you know, places where they are, not just the people, but the physical places. Cotton is rough on the soil, and coal, obviously. and then that it requires this large labor force is the most damning thing mm-hmm. of basically enforcing a sub-citizenship on a set of people in order for it to be practiced the way it is.
Yeah.
And another thing that we try to be clear about in the book is that these are industries that don't just impact these regions themselves, but really are fundamental to the industrialization of the whole country.
Yes.
That and even the world, right, is cotton that's picked by enslaved people and tenant farmers in the South, financed by northern banks, spreads across the country, and then actually goes overseas, right, to textile mills mm-hmm. in the United Kingdom. Tobacco, you know, coal is really driving a lot of this industrialization. And so we're all complicit, I think, in that.
Yeah.
I tend to think of I'm aware of a lot of the benefits of capitalism as well. Mm-hmm. That overall it has raised living standards over the last 100 plus years with the costs. But I think anything taken in its most extreme form, yeah. right? And in this case, it's incredibly extreme, does violence to the place and does violence to the people. And the fallout of that just sets in almost a path dependency, I think, sort of a trajectory that is maybe not impossible to get out of, but incredibly, incredibly hard for communities.
Yeah. I mean, it is really interesting to think about coal, tobacco, cotton— and agriculture and yeah. and how they are really different capitalist forces in the 20th century especially than they had been and that there's this flip side to all they create for us it's all that they take from some people in order to do it but that leads me back to Detroit because mm-hmm. we are such an important piece of that 20th century growth and explosion of industry. Certainly, you can find parallels between places in Southeast Michigan and some of these other places. Yeah. But overall, we're not quite in the same position. Is that the difference between rural communities and cities, or is there something else going on?
Yeah. So, when you sort of try to build theory as a social scientist, you explore patterns in a place and then see how they can be applied in others. And in Michigan, I think is a place that can almost confirm or lend support. So of those 100 most disadvantaged places that we study, 90+% of them are rural. But Detroit and Flint are also
into the category because of the
and then Cleveland mm-hmm. And some other sort of Rust Belt cities. And so you're right in that Detroit didn't quite follow the model as extreme and extractive, right? Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. there is this move as all of our eggs get put into the auto basket to build working class jobs, right? That actually fuels a lot of migration from the Cotton Belt, but also Appalachia. Yes. So there's a huge great migration from Appalachia mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. And that builds up an industry that creates a tremendous amount of wealth. A lot of it goes to the top, but on average, more goes to those sort of closer to the bottom.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, we continue to be an incredibly segregated city, right? So the social order of segregation gets enforced in Detroit.
Yeah.
And then as that industry, I think those forces lead to sort of the collapse of the city. And then the industry decline follows a similar pattern to all of these places.
Yeah.
And we have a... We have a chapter in the book called Revolt and Retribution, mm-hmm. which is about how in each one of these places, at some point, the have-nots rise up. And they say, we're not going to take it anymore. And there's some really incredible stories and big wins in that. And also, there's always retribution.
Yeah.
There's always a price to be paid. And sometimes it's violence, and sometimes it's people moving out. And then sort of a concerted effort to, as a city comes to be controlled by the have-nots, to make sure it fails,
yeah.
right, in the broader region. And I think you can see some parallels there, too.
Yeah, yeah. So I also want to talk about isolation and the role physical isolation plays
yeah.
in perpetuating this kind of poverty. And I bring that up specifically from my own experience in Eastern Kentucky.
Yeah.
I mean, I grew up in Detroit and was used to seeing a certain kind of poverty. The physical isolation in Eastern Kentucky is unimaginable, I think, to someone who grew up in a city.
Yeah.
How hard it is to get from wherever you are to any place else, but especially to something better, right?
Yeah.
The idea of mobility being tied to opportunity is one of the things that really holds them back. And I imagine that that is a commonality, a rural commonality in these other places as well.
Yeah, the scale, the density is a challenge. And so there's a good amount of literature that finds like social services, nonprofit services, community organizations tend to be clustered in urban areas because mm-hmm. that's where you can impact more
people
folks,
are.
Right?
Yeah.
And in rural communities, much less so. And in fact, many of our federal programs that you might apply for to bring resources on this stuff into your community, they're almost stacked towards being able to go to urban areas mm-hmm. and not these rural areas. And in many more ways than just a really important one, which is that you need good grant writers to do those things, and there's fewer of those in rural communities. So mm-hmm. when we were in Manchester in Clay County in Kentucky, we started talking to families. And, of course, the opioid epidemic is really on people's minds.
Yes.
And we think of that actually as the most recent extractive industry, that region was really targeted by pharmaceuticals going mm-hmm. in as being susceptible, and you saw the growth there and disproportionate harm done for an industry that is like preying really on the bodies of people.
Yes, yes. And has been doing it to that region for a long time.
Long time. Far before
the opioid crisis, when I was living in Eastern Kentucky, we used to call what people were taking, we called them nerve pills. They called them nerve pills.
Yeah, that's
right. Kind of a pre-opioid kind of escapism. But you would go to people's homes and they would have a candy dish on the coffee table.
Yeah.
With these
there's
pills.
A history of this going back, again, more than 100 years.
Yeah, yeah.
So we would talk to families about, you know, if things got better in your community, what would it look like?
Mm-hmm.
And time and time again, people would say, kids get into drugs because there's nothing else to do, nothing to do but drugs. We want more stuff for the kids to be able to do. And at first, honestly, we didn't take that seriously. It sounds sort of like, how could that have
it sounds
know,
under
explain
right?
this like huge, you know, complex problem. But once we heard it over and over again, you really start to have to look at it. And this this research on the impacts of social isolation and the positive impacts of these, we use the word social infrastructure. These are like the places where people can come together,
mm-hmm.
as much as possible across differences and build social connections and have cheap fun, if you will.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
One of them is, like, the arcade.
Mm-hmm.
So arcades are, like, surprisingly good places for people to go and meet people and have fun with others. And you think about replacing the arcade with somebody playing video games and by themselves
in their
living room.
Right, yeah. Wow.
So we talked to Angus Deaton about this. He's a Nobel laureate in economics who— wrote a book about the opioid crisis, and he said, you know, I don't just think it's a real issue. It's, like, one of the most important issues. Mm-hmm. And he sent us to some research. One of my favorite studies is about lab rats. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to compare people to lab rats. I'm sorry about that. But if you expose an isolated lab rat to drugs, they will often get addicted, and they will often overdose. But if that cute little lab rat has other cute lab rat friends and fun stuff to do in a cage, they will only use the drugs recreationally. They will very rarely overdose and never die.
Huh.
And Angus,
so it is about contact and socialization.
Yeah. So all of this research finds, like, having a great conversation, like, triggers things, like, similarly to drugs.
To drugs.
And so we're sort of replacing some of that, like, brain activity with drugs.
Yeah.
Just one more quick piece of research. So Angus led us to this research on Vietnam vets. So it turns out American soldiers in Vietnam used drugs in mass quantities while they were there. Mm-hmm. And Nixon was really concerned about this, and so he commissioned a very rigorous study and found, asked soldiers, why do you do drugs? And they said, when we're not out, there's nothing else to do.
What else is there?
Yeah, drugs were cheap, so that was another piece. But, huge amount of drug use, often, like, at levels that we would consider highly addicted. Mm-hmm. And when they returned to the United States— into well-structured lives with jobs and families, they stopped using drugs at, like, levels that most of our models suggest would be impossible.
Wow. But again, that socialization was what drove that.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Having this sort of connections, having structure to our lives and the connections with other people, we think can really drive it. So, opioids and overdose continue to be an incredibly complicated issue. But what if building splash parks is a part of the answer, where people can make connections, or local movie theaters? And so that's part of what this book tries to do, is give us a chance to look at hard issues in from new vantage points.
I also, of course, want to talk about race. These four communities are diverse in the sense that they're not all majority African American. You have two that are.
Yeah.
But there's a white community, and there's a community that is largely Latino. What does this tell us about what we know about the role that race plays in opportunity and economics and the history of discrimination, which wouldn't explain, for instance, Appalachia as well as it does the Cotton Belt or the Tobacco Belt?
Yeah, we want to link the story of these places together, but at the same time, I think it's important to recognize that it takes its most brutal and most exploitative form in the Cotton Belt and the Tobacco Belt.
Because of race.
Because of race. Enslavement and then tenant farming is just many orders of magnitude more brutal and exploitative than what we see in any of the other places. Mm-hmm. But I think in also trying to link it to this broader pattern of what's going on in the other places, it can give us more insights into the story behind it. So the story that we are telling about race starts as an economic story.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in that, we take a similar view as Ida B. Wells, right, who really understood and, so many of her writings identify that physical violence, right, state-sponsored violence against Black Americans was at its heart one of sort of economic supremacy.
Yes.
And so all of the social issues get sort of wrapped around it, but that's the fundamental piece.
Yeah, designed to keep people poor.
Designed to keep people poor. Yeah, some people poor and some people rich or, you know, higher income to reinforce that economic order. And then everything else gets layered on top of it. One of the interesting things about South Texas is that it's actually, it ends up being some of the same players mm-hmm. As it is in the Cotton Belt. So some of the families who are, you know, running plantations as cotton, you know, starts to run out of the soil, basically, it gets harder and harder. They actually pick up and move to South Texas as they figure out irrigation. And there's this sort of steady supply of folks who are coming across the border.
Yeah.
And they create a whole nother structure, which is not as brutal and as, but is built on the same principles of reinforcing the sort of sub-citizenship.
Yeah.
So the migratory farm pattern of, you know, South Texas up into the Midwest and then through Michigan for cherries,
sure.
and then back down, there would be all the primary elections would be done, you know, while farmers are not in the community. You know, they're trying to reinforce that social order. And in some cases, you have this documentation where they say they're actually learning from their experiences in the Cotton Belt to sort of create this new system on top of them. So they are directly linked.
Right, right. Okay, we're going to take another quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Luke Schaefer, co-author of The Injustice of Place. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. Talking with Luke Schaefer, professor of social justice and social policy at the University of Michigan, director of Poverty Solutions, and co-author of the book, The Injustice of Place, here on Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm glad you're with us. Luke, I want to spend some time talking about how we take what you've learned from this deep dive into rural places, rural poverty, and apply it in places like Detroit. As you point out, there are some urban places that kind of rank among these 100 poorest places that you looked at, but most of them are rural. But when we think about poverty in this country, I think our minds instantly go to big cities. And because we live in Southeast Michigan, of course, Detroit is the thing we think of. What does this tell us about what we're doing and what we could do better?
Well, with my first book, $2 a Day, it was a very simple story that sometimes money
wages.
Can really help.
Raise wages, right? Yeah, or something, right?
Yeah. Child tax credit, you know. This is a much more complicated story.
It is. This is so what you're outlining here is systemic, right? I mean, these are institutions.
Yeah.
That keep people from opportunity. Yeah. And that's different from policy, I guess, in my mind.
Yeah. Yeah. So one interesting part of this project was that we also visited the other side of the index.
Mm-hmm.
We went up into the upper Midwest to find the places that had the lowest poverty, the longest life expectancies, the highest rates of social mobility, actually are like disproportionately in rural Minnesota and some in Wisconsin. And those places are predominantly white,
mm-hmm.
but there are a lot of places around the country that are have that are predominantly white or, you know, have similar demographic profiles that don't look like these places. And so we were searching back once again to history to try to figure out what was going on. And the thing that we came to is that they all disproportionately benefited from the Homestead Act.
Mm-hmm.
And you can really see that in these communities. There's not like one big plantation. It was surrounded by, you know, shacks. There's family plot after family plot after family plot, and just broad-based ownership of the communities.
Yeah. So for listeners who don't know
yeah.
what the Homestead Act looks like, just explain it really quickly.
Yeah. So the 1862 Homestead Act that was only passed because the South had seceded and Southern lawmakers didn't like the idea, made land out west in these regions in particular very accessible to mm-hmm. people who could get there.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had a community that was the history evolved around pretty much anyone who got out there having a stake, a literal stake,
mm-hmm.
right,
mm-hmm.
In the community and just broad-based assets. And we actually started down that path after the Civil War in the South, too. Sherman and I think Lincoln's Treasury Secretary go down to Savannah and they gather a group of black leaders and they say, what do you want as we start out on this new thing? And,
right.
and they said, we want land.
Right.
We want assets.
Yeah.
And that started us down Reconstruction and 40 acres, which then when Lincoln is killed, completely reverses.
Yes.
So I think that's a starting point of wanting to understand the importance of making sure that people have that they're bought into communities, however that looks.
Yeah.
And I think you can let that idea evolve to things like industry, where if we're all, you know, locked up in one egg, right,
mm-hmm.
of an industry, whether it's cars or cotton or whatever, that does make us really, really vulnerable. And so wanting to diversify, wanting to try to take advantage of the assets we have, it's not a clear path, but it gives us some sense of where to go. And then the only other thing I'll say is that the book tries to identify many of the mechanisms by which deep disadvantage is persistent over time and mm-hmm. Takes us in to places that really surprised me, including local government corruption.
Yeah.
Many times been going on for generations and in eastern Kentucky,
mm-hmm.
you know, you have a handful of families that have controlled
yes.
the spoils for a long time.
Forever. Yeah.
And so using local journalism and other means to try to right that ship and also, frankly, give local leaders more support
mm-hmm.
in trying to do the incredibly hard work of governing and not get sucked into the same patterns of corruption that these communities have seen for generations sometimes.
Yeah. Our producer, Carrie Jr. II, has a specific question for
I do.
The conversation.
Yeah. And it fits actually really nicely with what you just
Great.
Gave us, outlining some solutions. I was wondering if the solutions for these problems are area specific. Like, would you solve the issues of poverty in a city the same way you would in this rural town, and what that might look like?
We think a big part of the solution of poverty has to do with standardized federal policy.
Mm.
So we see things like the expanded child tax credit that rolled out really quite equally across the entire country. And we're hearing more stories today about food assistance that is not being accepted in some states and
mm-hmm.
being accepted in others. And I think we're actually seeing an increasing splitting apart of different states and the resources that are available to people. But we also are not ready to give up on place-based support, in part because these places that we're writing about have gotten so little over time that goes to the poorest families. So I think we're trying to figure out how you do that without the risk of elite capture, right? Sometimes that is, you know, corrupt, but a lot of times it could just be, you know, the ideas of the folks that are in charge are the ones that go. Can we have something that actually gets more people involved and in deciding how those resources should be used. Can we look at different ways to do it, like mm-hmm. opening a local movie theater yeah. and the benefits that we didn't think of that? And then I think there can be some other policies that can disproportionately have a positive impact on these places. I'll give one example: minimum teacher salaries. So if a state put money behind a policy saying everybody, you know, who's a starting teacher, you know, has to be above this threshold, it wouldn't impact necessarily higher income communities. You would apply it to a higher income community, but if their starting salaries are already above that, right. it has no impact on them. But it could lift up, like, struggling school districts. And we actually know, like, the quality of new teachers is one of our best sort of evidence-based approaches to improving educational equity in the country.
Yeah.
So it sounds like there's no specifically catered approach that you need to take for the area, but it's that you spend more attention or time with efforts in those areas, the areas that are more disproportionately
affected. Yeah, that's right. I think this is a story of place-based, very thoughtful place-based policies that are mm-hmm. aware of the history of elite capture, that the resources don't necessarily go to those places, but wants to sort of right the wrong that these places and the folks who are struggling have disproportionately been left behind by what we try to do for generations.
Yeah. Please let me chime in, Stephen.
What about the idea of trying to remove place from the equation? In other words, could we move people to a better place?
Yeah.
And I know there's a lot wrapped up in that, and that's not fair in many ways. But I think a lot of people ask that question, especially in places that are so isolated. Would it be better if they were somewhere else?
Yeah, this comes up a lot, and there's no record of us actually having a successful policy of it. And then I think it's important to understand that people have connections to the place.
Yeah.
You know, we could say, well, Detroit's down to 600,000, you know, sorry, Mayor Duggan, 650,000.
Even at that number, it's just way down, right?
And maybe we should just, even collapsing the city becomes very, very hard, right? But not having it, like, people have deep ties to these places. They're very meaningful. And when we were in each of these communities, we could see, you know, so much beauty, so much connection. The Spinach Festival in Crystal City is an awesome annual event. You know, they crown the Spinach Princess and the Spinach Queen. I think there's a spinach eating contest that you might have to sign a waiver for.
Of course there would have to be, right?
Yeah. So I think that people are connected to the places, and especially when you don't have a lot, sort of the idea of leaving what you have becomes even less appealing, right? To say, oh, if I just move to an urban place where I have no social network, I have no human capital of how to navigate it, I think that is not appealing to people. But the biggest part is, like, people have a connection to where they've grown up and where they live, and I bet many of us can feel that in our own communities, and I think we have to treat that sort of human impulse with dignity and care.
Okay. Luke Schaefer, Director of Poverty Solutions at the University of Michigan and author, co-author of The Injustice of Place. Really great work and really great to hear about how you did it. Thanks so much for joining us on Created Equal.
It was such a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for letting me in on that conversation a little bit. I got to ask a question.
I thought you had a great question. So yeah. Why not have you ask it yourself?
Yeah, I was really trying to get to better understand, like, the takeaways here outside of just, you know, these rural areas are, we don't often think about these rural areas when it comes to poverty.
Right.
And it's really interesting to hear that these solutions, you know, they can be applied in different areas, but you've got to be more particular about paying attention.
That's right.
To these areas. So,
yeah.
I enjoyed that conversation.
I mean, this idea of the commonality among these regions that they wrote about, the relationship to big industry and right. how they so devastated these places physically, but yeah. also in terms of human capital, I think is something we have got to start paying a lot more attention to.
With cities, I think it's more clear when mm-hmm. you have large empty buildings mm-hmm. and like Detroit, where you have neighborhoods that have a lot of space. But with rural communities, you don't think about that when you go out there. You expect space.
That's
you
right. That's
that
right.
Stuff. So, yeah.
And you can't always identify that something terrible has happened to the people there.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that's a wrap.
Good conversation. On to the next one. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. Our audio editing is by Connor Anderson, and the music is by Sam Bobian. Our digital production team is Jenny Sherman, Dave Kim, and Sophia Joswiak. Our program director is Adam Fox. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.